ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi there, this is David Rutledge with you once again for The Philosopher's Zone. Welcome to the show. I'm going to start this week with a story. Once upon a time, actually it was in 2022, a man was booking a flight ticket with Air Canada. He went online and he got talking with a chatbot on the Air Canada website. The chatbot told him that he qualified for a discount, but that he should pay the full fare up front and then apply for the discount after he'd made his journey. So he did just that. He bought his full fare ticket and then he took his flight. But then later on, when he came to apply for his discount, Air Canada told him that he wasn't actually able to do that and directed him to their terms and conditions, which stated that discount requests had to be submitted before flying. So the chatbot got it wrong. Anyway, the whole thing ended up in court, where Air Canada argued that the chatbot, even though it existed on their website, was, quote, a separate legal entity that is responsible for its own actions, unquote, and that the company shouldn't be held responsible for any misinformation that the chatbot generated. Well, you'll be pleased to hear that Air Canada lost the case, and the customer got his discount along with damages and court costs. So that's the end of the story, unless you're a philosopher, in which case it's just a springboard to some very interesting reflection on language and intention and AI and what we call speech acts, the kinds of utterances, written or spoken, that don't just describe the world, but make things happen in the world. AI is increasingly being used to generate speech acts, especially in the workplace, where AI-generated communication can hire you or tell you to do things or perhaps terminate your employment. And this raises the question of what exactly gives a speech act its effective force? Because if the answer is something like intention, well, AI may or may not be capable of intention. The jury's out on that one, which means that that AI-generated email telling you to submit your report by Friday may or may not carry the authority that you think it does. So I'm talking this week about AI and speech acts with Chris Cousins, who's a lecturer in moral and political philosophy at the University of Glasgow.
The basic idea of speech acts rather than just speech or communication more generally is that when we're talking to each other, we're not just trying to get information across, even though we're sometimes doing that. We're also often trying to do lots of other really complex things. For example, when I say, I promise to go to the shops to get some milk, I'm not just telling you something about what I'm hoping to or intending to do. I'm also making a promise. I'm doing this special thing called promising. And that leads to a lot of really important normative or moral or ethical considerations. I can break a promise. That's a really bad thing. It's much worse than me just failing to do something I'd intended to do. And so speech act theory is a branch of philosophy of language trying to unpack what these speech acts are and how we perform them. How do we go about doing all of these weird and wonderful things with words? How do I bring about the moral burden of having promised such that if I fail to do that thing, I've actually done something pretty bad that might really undermine our relationship?
Okay, so just to be clear then, the difference between I promise I will be faithful to you for as long as we're married and I feel cold today is that the former has an effect in the world. It sort of makes something happen in terms of our sort of ethical, moral obligations to each other. That's what you're getting at there.
Yeah, and I think speech acts are really important because we use them all the time. You know, we promise, we offer, we invite, we order, we request. And all of those have different kinds of changes in our obligations, what we're supposed to do for each other, what we owe to each other. And then the way that we go about interacting with people is often shaped by those obligations that we feel. And something really important is understanding what those are. We both need to be on the same page for us to be working effectively as sort of moral, mutually bound agents. That's where the language can be really important. If I say, you know, I promise to be faithful for as long as we're married in a marriage ceremony in front of people, it's really clear what I mean and how binding that's supposed to be. But if I say, I'll give you a lift to the airport, have I promised or have I done something that's not quite a promise? One of those has a much bigger burden than the other. And if I turn around tomorrow and say, oh, sorry, actually, I can't, Well, you might have not booked a taxi. You might miss your flight because you were relying on the moral burden of me having promised. But if I don't use those exact words, I promise, sometimes we get into disagreement or a breakdown in communication about not just what we meant or what the kind of content of a promise might be, but whether or not a promise even occurred, whether that moral obligation actually exists.
Okay, so according to traditional speech act theory then, how is the force of a speech act determined? Like, what is it about a speech act that gives it that power to make things happen?
So there's various views on this. The kind of classic statement, or the easiest way perhaps to get a handle on this, would be to think about what the speaker intends. So if a speaker says, "I promise to drive you to the airport," and we're trying to work out if they've really promised, we might look at the words they've used, but also if they really meant them. If they were telling a joke, I'm not sure what kind of an actually funny joke would have that as one of the parts of it. But if they're telling a joke and one of the lines is, you know, "I'll promise to drive you to the airport," well, we don't think they've really promised because they weren't trying to promise. They didn't intend to do that. They were just telling a joke. In the same way, people who get married in a movie and say all the lines that would require them to be married don't suddenly become married. Even if the actor performing as the celebrant might be legally entitled to marry people, it still doesn't end up counting as a marriage because the people who are saying those things don't intend for it to count as a marriage or a promise or whatever else it might be. So one way to try and work out if a promise actually occurred or if any particular kind of speech act has occurred might be to look at what the person who said those words was actually trying to do with them, if they were trying to make a promise.
So that's what we call the intentionalist theory then. The salient factor there is the intention of the speaker. We also have what's called the conventionalist theory, which I think is a really interesting one. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so the inverse of asking, well, what was the speaker intending when they spoke, might be to ask, well, what did the audience of the speech take to have happened? What was the listener or the person they were trying to promise to? What was the recipient's response? You might look at that in terms of, you know, what's going on in their head. That's one way of potentially going about it. Another way is to look at the public response. This is Quill Cookler's view on conventionalist theories of speech acts, for some philosophical jargon for you. But the general idea is not just that what happens inside people's heads is important, but what they publicly display or what you can actually see sort of from the outside. So you might say something to me and I might think that you're promising, but if I don't respond in the right way, if I don't maybe say something like, "Thank you for promising," or some other kind of acknowledgement, or act as though I take you to have promised, then maybe the promise hasn't taken root yet. You might have said something and tried to promise, but I might have missed that or mistaken something. And so the audience's response, their uptake, might be a really important way of working out, you know, what speech act has happened, what obligations have actually come about.
So you've been doing some really interesting work on this with regard to how speech acts operate in the workplace. Tell me about what kinds of speech acts we typically find being deployed in the workplace.
There's a few different levels to this, and one of those is that the ordinary speech acts that we perform all the time, promises, requests, suggestions, commands, those happen in the workplace too. But when they happen in the workplace, they often take on a sort of heightened status, I think. If you fail to live up to a promise with your friends, that might be bad. But if you fail to do that at work, that can be worse in terms of threatening your job or your livelihood. So whilst I think some of the speech acts we perform every day are the same as the ones that we do at work, they matter more, and it matters more when there's a breakdown or an error in communication as to how we repair that. On the other hand, workplaces also often have lots of really specific institutional things we can do with words. You can close a meeting, you could hire a new employee, you could fire an employee as well with words. And that's really important because, yeah, again, this is people's sources of income, what kind of quality of life they can enjoy, what their dependents can rely upon. And so when you can change someone's status from being employed to being unemployed with a speech act, it becomes really important what we intend to do, how we understand each other's intentions or how we understand each other's speech in these really heightened or fraught kind of examples. And there's realms of workplace legislation and precedent and employer tribunals that have negotiated or tried to work through these in individual cases. And so different jurisdictions are going to have different answers as to exactly which utterances count as firing someone, exactly what conditions do you have to meet before you can be legally said to have offered someone employment, for example.
Well, tell me about how speech acts in the workplace have been affected by the advent of AI and what we're going to call LLMs, these large language models that power AI.
One thing that we're seeing increasingly is an influence of large language models on workplace communication, and different industries or different jobs are going to be encountering this in different ways. Working in a university, when it comes to student work, we are constantly encountering instances that might look like or might appear to be students using AI to generate some of their assessments. Different universities or different assessment tasks within those universities will have different policies with what to do about that. But these are kinds of communication looking or communicative things that we might encounter in the workplace that are being surreptitiously replaced by AI. And I think that there's lots of other ways that people are going to increasingly use AI to do things that previously they might have done themselves. Sometimes that can be a bit nefarious or questionable, like with students using it to grade their work, or as we've seen recently in America, university teachers using AI to assess student work instead of doing it themselves. There's problems when these really important kind of high stakes tasks are being outsourced to AI without human oversight, because normally we can follow up or we can challenge someone's assessment of our work. We can say, you know, why did you give me that grade? We can, you know, if we're fired, we can ask why we were fired. If we've been told to do something that we think is unethical, we could ask why we've been told to do it. But if that's being automatically generated, as more of our communication happens online, especially if we're receiving all of these, these speech acts, these instructions and commands by email, increasingly, we're just not going to be able to track or be sure about whether they've come from a human speaker or if they've been automatically generated. And so I think that we're going to be increasingly uncertain about the origin of online communication that we receive. And in a workplace environment, that becomes particularly tricky to navigate because we are so invested in keeping our promises, following orders, discharging our duties in a workplace in a way where the stakes might be higher than just in our day-to-day lives.
So then how this pertains to speech act theory then, if I have you right here, is that if I get an AI-generated email ordering me to do something, then the absence of a human speaker with human intention raises the question of whether this order has any force and whether or not I'm therefore compelled to reply. That's the issue here?
Yeah, at least for me, one of the key things that hasn't really been explored or that we are still negotiating socially is trying to work out what should we do when we get these kinds of automatically generated instructions or orders or commands. Are we supposed to follow them? Do we have an obligation to do what we've been told to do in the same way that we would if it was sent by a human speaker? It might be easy to just say, look, if AI did it, we don't have to. But increasingly, AI is being used to outsource decision making, and that means that we might be told by our institution that we should do whatever the AI tells us to do. It kind of takes on the proxy force or the status of a proper order. Even if it's not intended by a human speaker, our employer might have told us, look, it counts as something we intended to tell you. You still have to do it when you receive it. Unfortunately, there's still going to be kind of grey areas or problem cases where we just don't know if the order has been sent by a human speaker or automatically generated by a large language model. And we might not have policies or frameworks in place to tell us what we're actually supposed to do when we get AI instructions or if we're not sure about them. And one thing that at the moment is a bit of a hodgepodge of solutions is that in different areas or different countries, what we're actually supposed to do or what our legal obligations might be is being determined by, you know, decisions at the court level. We wait until something goes horribly wrong, a court rules on what is actually supposed to happen, and that becomes precedent going forward in that area. But that might mean that we end up with pretty different solutions to these kind of puzzles in different places. And maybe this is where philosophy could be helpful in suggesting what should be those resolutions, what kinds of policies or what kinds of frameworks should institutions or workplace tribunals adopt when it comes to resolving the problems that happen when people either don't comply with orders because they thought they were automatically generated or do something that they shouldn't have because they got an erroneous AI email. Those kind of problems are the ones that maybe there's scope to be prevented with some good policy or at least frameworks for handling these kinds of questions going forward.
I have a technical question here, which may or may not be relevant, but I was watching something on YouTube the other day and an ad for Grammarly came up, this AI-generated program that corrects your syntax and spelling. I always get ads for Grammarly. YouTube thinks I'm incredibly interested in Grammarly, and I'm not, YouTube, if you're listening. So what if I write an email, but then use Grammarly to correct my syntax and spelling? Grammarly makes a number of changes to my text before I send it. You could call that a sort of hybrid speech act generated partly by me and partly by an algorithm. Does that raise the same sort of issue, or is that just a very small sort of technical nitpick?
In one way, it sort of avoids the issue because you've kind of deliberately sent the email, even if you haven't deliberately sort of endorse all of the contents. And so it becomes kind of easy for me as the recipient to put you on the hook for it because it's something you played a part in creating, even if you weren't really thinking it through. But that doesn't quite tell us whether or not, if we're talking about, you know, different speech acts, whether or not you actually really promised, whether it's fair for me to put you on the hook in that way, if you send me something that seems to be binding you to some course of action. But in actual fact, it's the prompts of Grammarly that have led you in that direction. Something that I've encountered sometimes is that, you know, people will just do whatever Grammarly tells them without thinking through the consequences of the changes that it's suggesting. And so you might intend to ask me to do something. If we assume like that you're my boss, you might ask me to finish some task by the end of the day. And you just mean for me to put that further in up my list of priorities. But Grammarly might think that your phrasing was indirect or it could be improved or punchier. And it says you should change this to say, instead of could you please finish that task by the end of the day, change it to finish this by the end of the day. And that sort of subtle change in phrasing might change how I interpret what you send. What initially you had just meant to be a kind of benign request, I might interpret as an order. I might suddenly feel that even my job is on the line if I fail to do that in a way that you didn't intend. And that's going to have lots of unintended consequences, potentially. I might stay late to finish that work in a way that you didn't plan. That I think is pretty, that's one of the maybe more foreseeable consequences of automatically generated workplace communication, is that there's a tendency towards this kind of heightened phrasing, suggesting that maybe people will take things to be orders or take them to have a lot more obligations to do things than they're actually supposed to have. Maybe an impetus or an incentive towards overwork. But also, I guess on the flip side, if people are going to be working more or ending up being more stressed trying to comply with synthetic or automatically generated instructions, then that's going to lead to worse outcomes in terms of the work that they're producing. Or if they're staying late to finish extra work, I guess paying them more overtime in certain industries. It's really hard to predict exactly how the adoption of this kind of technology is going to pan out, because there's so many unknowns about not only what AI can do now, but what AI will be able to do in 1 year or 2 years or 5 years, whether or not some other kind of technology will replace it, or if we might end up realizing that some of the things that YouTube ads are telling us to use AI for, it turns out we don't actually need it to do those things.
On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, you're in the Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and my guest this week is Chris Cousins, lecturer in moral and political philosophy at the University of Glasgow. On this issue, though, of whether or not, or the extent to which AI-generated orders should be complied with, it seems that the philosophical issue is particularly acute if we look at it through the intentionalist speech act theory, right? This idea that the force of an utterance comes from the intention of the speaker, and so the problem is, you know, does AI have intention or not? What about if we go with the conventionalist theory of speech acts, according to which the force of the speech act comes from the uptake of the audience? Does that clear things up to any helpful degree?
I think this is a theoretically more profitable direction to take. I have worries about putting too much weight on the intention of the speaker, both in terms of general speech act theory, but especially when applied to large language models. Without derailing things to go too far back into that kind of intentionalist, conventionalist discussion, if the speaker gets to decide what speech act has ultimately been performed, it's very easy for bad actors to wriggle off the hook when they shouldn't. You know, if you say something that everyone thinks is supposed to be a promise, but ultimately it's just up to the speaker what they actually did, you can very easily just say, oh no, I didn't promise. And we might think that's not so bad with promising. It's probably good to be able to retract a promise if you've changed your mind. With other kinds of things, like a bet, for example, we maybe don't want people to be able to wriggle out of bets really easily just by saying, oh no, I didn't really mean to bet, and can ratchet that up even further. Maybe you have offered someone a job and they have quit their other job to take up that offer. If you were to turn around and say, oh no, I didn't really mean that to count as a job offer, then again, we end up with this sort of communication breakdown, and resolving it just by asking the speaker what they meant is probably not going to cut it for navigating the sort of moral minefield that gets created. And so a conventionalist approach, looking at how people have responded to the utterance, whether they seem to have taken that speech to count as a promise or an offer and so on, I think that's a more fruitful way to look at which speech act has been performed in general. And it's particularly helpful when it comes to artificial intelligence because, yeah, as you say, it doesn't really seem to be intending to do things in the same way that humans do.
So is this a purely theoretical issue, though, or have there been instances where workers have challenged the validity of AI-generated communication in the workplace on the grounds of, if it ain't human, it ain't legit?
Not to my knowledge, at least at the moment, you know, in the work that I've been starting to do in this area, the hope is more to forestall things going badly, I guess, rather than the current model of legislating AI, which seems to be wait until things do go badly and then see what the courts say as to what we are supposed to do about this. Maybe the closest example that I'm aware of is Air Canada was using a chatbot, a sort of artificial intelligence program that people could talk to on their website. And this chatbot made some promises to a customer that did not align with the company's policy. So when the customer tried to exercise the guarantees that the chatbot had made to them, Air Canada said that, well, that's not actually our policy. We don't have to do that. And so that ends up in court, and the court decides that actually Air Canada was responsible for whatever its chatbot said. And so that means that now, at least in Canada, we now have a clear understanding of what the legal ramifications of this are. But in our day-to-day interactions with large language models and the extent to which using AI in the workplace might be already changing the norms or the unspoken rules about how we should communicate online, how we should give people orders and commands and make promises through emails, for example. The outcomes of the renegotiations that we're having to do in the face of AI haven't been settled yet. And I think it might be quite some time before we have a really clear set of norms or frameworks that are going to tell us how we should interact with online speech.
Well, then, as you say, there are a lot of questions here that have not been settled. And in the absence of any universally agreed upon rules for determining whether or not AI can generate speech acts, how should a worker respond to an order issued via email from an AI, other than just play it safe and assume that the order has the requisite authority?
Yeah, although depending on the order, assuming that it has the requisite authority and that it's a real order might even not be playing it safe, especially if you've been instructed to do something unethical or that might contradict some of the institution's existing policies. AI has notorious problems with hallucinations, making things up. And so if we're getting automatically generated emails as part of our day-to-day work, we should be expecting some of those to be fabricated, made up, to not be based in the institution's actual policies and procedures. And that makes it pretty tricky to know what to do. There's kind of band-aids or short-term fixes. One might be to mark or flag synthetic content. So if you're a business that is adopting AI to automatically generate instructions or timetables and so on, maybe you should inform your employees that that's what's happening and that there should be a way for them to distinguish between synthetic and human-generated content. Sarah Fisher at Cardiff University has argued this, that we need to be flagging AI content so that we can know what set of norms or what kind of responses are most applicable. We can also have clear institutional framings. Again, this is more relying on helpful and forward-thinking employers to tell their employees what they're supposed to do when it comes to an order or an instruction from an AI program, or where it's unclear if your boss sent it themselves or if it was an AI assistant. In general, maybe a good rule of thumb is to follow up to double check that the content or the instruction you've been given is in fact one that the employer on which it's been delivered is one that they endorse. They do actually want you to do that thing. That's a way to avoid accidentally doing something that the employer doesn't want you to do. But then the flip side of that is now you have to follow up and second guess and double check things that previously you could have just gone along with. So there's a trade-off or a cost in the kind of obvious ways that we might try and get a sort of easy way to respond to or negotiate this. I think ultimately there needs to be just clear instruction and not negotiation, but clear explanations of institutional expectations when employers are adopting AI and large language models into their existing workflows. And that without that, employers are maybe exposing themselves to these kinds of communication breakdowns, and employees are then exposed to the consequences of those. And of course, if it all ends up in court, as it did with Air Canada, we don't necessarily know what the resolution is going to be.
I guess that if we get to the point where these large language models are thought of as being capable of intention, then a lot of these questions are resolved, and not necessarily in a way which is going to be good for workers. But, you know, I mean, my understanding of large language models, I think like a lot of people who know a bit but not a lot about this sort of thing, is that they just operate on the basis of pattern recognition, probability. They're just repeating the contents of data sets without really understanding what they're saying. But I know that some AI researchers believe that LLMs are at least partially able to understand their own speech. And, you know, there's a whole can of worms there that we could open when it comes to what it means to understand. But if these researchers are correct, then it could be that we don't necessarily need a retooled speech act theory. What are your thoughts on this issue of AI and just its capacity for understanding and perhaps its capacity for intention?
So I think that the, I guess, unbounded possibility of what AI could be capable of will include intentions. And we see this in like science fiction examples of AI programs and robots and androids from Star Trek and Red Dwarf and things like that, where computer programs are portrayed as having pretty much exactly human kinds of mental patterns and ways of thinking. And they seem to basically have everything that is required for understanding and intention and so on. And large language models don't appear to have that yet. As you say, they're mostly trained on pattern recognition and predicting the next token in a string of sentences and so on. And there is debate as to whether even the large language models we have now have already kind of gone beyond that. The academic debate is slightly behind the actual state of affairs when it comes to things being created, because most of the AI research on new developments in AI are being driven by industry rather than things coming out of purely academic or university contexts. And so there's always a bit of an advantage in having your technology not be sort of publicly explained and everyone doesn't know exactly how it works. Which is a kind of long-winded way of saying it's definitely possible that AI in the future, or even now, is doing some kind of intending in the way that would align with this idea of needing to intend to perform a particular speech act. However, there's at least a couple of ways that I think we don't have the same kind of intentions coming out of large language models. One of those is what might be called communicative intention. Large language models, we might think, intend to produce certain kinds of text. They might intend to put together words in such and such a way in response to a prompt. But the leap from there to say that they intend to convey that information to a human listener or a human reader, that they intend to tell the truth, for example, doesn't seem to be the case. So there's something going on in the realm, not maybe of intention at all, but the intention to communicate that large language models don't really seem to be in the business of. And some of my colleagues at Glasgow, Michael Hicks, James Humphrey, and Joe Slater, have written a paper on this, arguing that large language models just don't care about whether what they say is true or not, because they don't have the capacity to care about things, whereas human speakers do care about the truth of what they say. Another way in which intention in large language models, even if we want to say they can intend to do some kinds of things, they don't seem to be able, at least as I understand it, to intend to undertake obligations, to intend to bring about new normative statuses between them and the person they're speaking to. So when you say, "I promise to do something," you're intending to take on the burden of a promise. You're intending to expose yourself to sanctions or to some kind of moral failure if you don't do what you've promised. And I don't see anything in the work on large language models that suggests that they are able to intend to undertake those kind of obligations, to have intentions related to a sort of interpersonal relationship or to a moral relationship. So it's really hard to talk about the capabilities of large language models without accidentally anthropomorphizing in ways that might at least be questionable. So I'm definitely open to saying that they can intend to do some kind of things in a recognizable sense of intention. But for the purposes of these speech acts, for the purposes of normatively binding and morally weighty speech acts, I'm not convinced yet that they are capable of having those kind of intentions to communicate, to care about the truth of what they say, and to intend to undertake moral obligations. But it's possible that we might come up with some technology, a future generation of AI that is able to do these things. And then those kind of concerns won't apply to that future technology. But I'm not seeing that yet from the kinds of large language models that we're currently getting to use, at least if we pay enough to use the updated versions of, you know, GPT-4 and Claude and so on.
Chris Cousins, lecturer in moral and political philosophy at the University of Glasgow. We'll put a link to Chris's website on our website. That's the Philosopher's Zone. And of course, while you're there, you can listen to this episode again, along with a vast back catalogue of earlier episodes. And don't forget ABC Listen, which is your one app to rule them all if you want to access all of that great Radio National content. Thanks so much for your company this week. This program was produced on Bundjalung Land by me, David Rutledge, and I will see you next time. Bye for now.